Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I've been away for the last few weeks, traveling in South America, in Peru, and it's good to be back. So today we're probably just going to have a chat, me and Maja, catch up, see where we're at, reflect a little bit about travel, about Peru, about going away and coming back to this absolutely insane, crazy world we live in. Whether, you know, it doesn't matter where you go. You can be living in Peru and go away and come back and you realize the crazy world you live in. It's a very interesting experiment in relativity travel. Of course, it's also a packaged experience, and every traveler knows the dance of trying to avoid becoming a mere tourist when, of course, in some fundamental technical sense, you always are one. So it's just, it's in some ways another avenue into the paradoxical intertwinglings of 21st century life. And with that, let's just bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daoum, who I have not spoken to for a number of weeks. Maja, how are you doing?
Hi, Eric. I'm doing really good. Thank you.
How's your May been? We haven't had a lot of contact this May.
I know. It's been a while. May for me has been pretty good. I've had a good May, but in keeping with larger themes, the month of May is actually National Mental Health Month. I don't know. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's actually National Mental Health Month. And all month, I have had a theme of mental health coming up all the time. And, I mean, I did a lecture this month on mental health specifically, but then it just has, like, shown up all over the place. And also in the media as well, on larger levels, not just in my own kind of circle. So I don't know. Did you run into any mental health stuff while you were in Peru?
Well, you know, in a way, it's always the that just thinking about other cultures and how they organize psychic reality inevitably raises these issues, you know, even the language of mental health versus more spiritual ways of understanding this, and also just thinking about the ways that different societies weave you know, psychological aberration into their network of reality. So it always kind of comes up in a striking way. And of course, you know, the whole I guess we call it the horrible tragedy of in UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah,
you know, that
totally
affected everybody, and people were talking about that. And you know, as a Californian and someone, you know, who watches these kinds of things as these sort of symptoms of God knows what.
Yeah.
You know, that was inevitably part of the vision as well. So I think that will definitely weave, you know, into our story. And it's also kind of interesting. It's like, why does one travel? You know, it's especially these days where, you know, when you travel, it's another kind of experience of the complexities, hazards, toxicity, stupidity of so much of our modern world. You can't help it. You know, you're there, you are, you're on the plane.
You know, isn't there, Eric, what is that? Is it like Jehovah's Witness or something? But there is some, like, faction of a religious group that feels like you shouldn't travel, like that it's, like, putting yourself at unnecessary risk. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have not heard of that. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. Well, just because some religious group somewhere probably thinks every possible thought, you know, that human beings can come up with. But that makes sense. I mean, you know, one of the things I said before, I mean, it's kind of a paradox where you, you know, if you're as a traveler, if you're going to a recognized destination, and, you know, I had never considered really going to Peru because I was interested in traveling other places and, you know, just never really came up. And I had a wonderful opportunity because I'm friends with an ethnobotanical, independently trained ethnobotanical expert, which is not a euphemism for just being into psychedelics, by the way. He's actually an ethnobotanical expert who's obsessed with Peru and has been there a dozen times. And one of the ways he affords to go there, it's kind of a brilliant move. More people should do this, is you kind of act as a tour guide, and you set up a tour. You know, you deal with the tour agencies, and you get the bus, and you get the deals at the hotels, blah, 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 except right. You just do it for your friends. So it's like you get good. To go on a tour with your friends. So it has all the convenience and sort of more than just being a single person or a dyad on a trip, which is its right. own kind of stressor. You're with this, you know, collective, but instead of being a bunch of random people, you know, and that's often not such a, you know, it's a dice roll, let's put it that way. you're with your pals or your pals' pals. You know, there were people on the trip that I hadn't met before. So it was a wonderful opportunity. I was like, sure, they're like, it's good. But it was kind of funny for me because I just actually didn't know that much about Peru. I'd never studied it very much. The Inca, sure, jungle.
Right, and it's funny, just to contrast, like what you just said, going with your friends. I mean, it really is funny. Like, if you've ever gone on, like, the package tour, the predicament that is the package tour, okay? These tours seem to suppose that it's an appropriate situation to just gather a whole bunch of strangers from all over the entire globe and then stick them all into these single groups that'll be together for these extended periods of time, going places they've never been before with total strangers, where everyone has to kind of like listen to this one person that says they know what's going on, and then you don't know who anybody is or what's happening. It could be like you're in another place, you know, they could be telling you anything. So it's kind of funny to see it, like, to take tours with people you know and have connections to, and that whole experience of the place, I would imagine, is so different than if you do it the total stranger in a strange land way.
Yeah, I mean, that's... You know, part of what I was thinking about was just how the quest to not just find yourself absorbed into the kind of typical tourist way of responding to the place, and it's a trap. And I don't even blame tourists. I'm not going to sit here and go, well, because I'm technically a tourist. I'm doing the same thing. But when you're a thinking tourist, And you're like, okay, got to avoid being a tourist, and yet you want to see some of the same places. You're going to go to the same sites. You're going to eat in some of the same restaurants. You're going to take advantage of the tourist infrastructure that's there. But there's this insidious feedback loop you enter into, because as a place becomes more popular, then it starts to package itself more and more explicitly for an idea of a kind of generic tourist. So it's just the same way that, like, the folk arts that people produce, and they've been producing them forever, and they've been things that people, tchotchkes that people sell to travelers for throughout the 20th century, but that feedback loop gets faster and faster, so that, for example, native weavers will start using, you know, traditional styles. We've knit caps that look like Batman because it's kind of funny, and then the tourists like it because the tourists go, oh, look, it's Batman. Oh, how cute. I want that. And so there's this distortion that enters, and it's always there to some degree in the encounter between different peoples. When there's any kind of money involved or any kind of projection or desire, it's always there, but it gets magnified so much by money and by these large sort of corporate tours that come in, that you're there in this weird zone where you're like, God, how do I dodge this beast and actually have an encounter with someone, with a place, with a thing? And yet you also are aware that you are inevitably part of the same thing. So it's kind of a mind, you know, it screws with your head a bit.
It's true, and especially if you just stick out like a sore thumb. You know, some people can manage to go incognito because they have ethnicity or something. But, like, I'm the whitest white person that ever whited. Like, I'm so white. Like, if, like for me to try to have a genuine experience.
Yeah, you kind of glow with whiteness.
I know, it's ridiculous. So, like, there's no way. I mean, I can't even come up off the subway in Brooklyn without just, like, calling attention to myself as not belonging there, you know? So there's no way.
In a way, it's almost to your advantage. It reminds me of... I met this crazy German guy who was at a media arts conference a long time ago, and it was always stuck in my head. He was talking about, he was a really dynamic person. You could tell he had a really creative life, led a very creative life, and was a real aggressively interesting person. And he talked about one of the tricks that he would do when he was traveling is, you know, was about kind of like taking advantage of that difference and then going even farther. So
he'd
go into he'd just like walk into a place, a restaurant, a bar, an area where people were hanging out, and of course he shows up and they're all thinking, oh, it's a Western tourist. And then he would pull out a toy trumpet and start playing a song and and put on goofy glasses. Like, so he would just outdo being the outsider, and so that it kind of broke their idea of the Western tourist, because, you know, that's one of the things you get into is you're just stuck in this zone where, like, if I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to be respectful, I'm trying to understand, but I'm also going to go through the same sorts of patterns that everybody else does. So, so that's one way. And the way that I work this time, and it was, you know, partly just I was lucky because I knew these people, but I did end up thinking a lot about one of the strategies to avoid or to sort of sidestep is a better word, because you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
But sidestep that kind of idiocy is to just study, is to know more about what you're actually studying. So, like, before I went, I read a bunch of books, I read some articles, and I was lucky that I was going with people who actually knew a lot of things. So there's a way that just plain old knowledge, studying, you know, reading some anthropology books, reading some books about botany, reading some histories, you're able to kind of move through and you know, recognize the same places, but there's a much deeper connection with it. And so I thought a lot about that, about how knowledge isn't just a dry, bunch of book learning that pulls you away from the true experience that you're there. It's like, actually, it enables you to have different kinds of experiences that are not more authentic, but they just have a different quality, maybe a deeper quality than just going and consuming the kind of novelty of the spaces and the places without necessarily having that kind of depth.
No, it's so true. Like, every time I've traveled to places really far away, I read so much, and then the way it becomes interactive for me, right, where I get to kind of like use my user interface or whatever nerdy thing you want to call it, but you'd be like out there and you'll see like the name of a thing that you read about, and you'll be like, oh my God, that's right over there, let's go check it out. Or like, you'll be able to have a deeper experience because you'll seek out the places that seem more amenable. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot that can be done through just chance and circumstance and going like surrealist style. But if you do take a little time beforehand, you can kind of find out what amazing, magical things other people have discovered there and take advantage of it.
Yeah, and I think they both play off each other. In fact, I think sometimes it's easier to get to the surrealist synchronicities if you also, you know, have built some kind of platform. I mean, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Sometimes the total random dice roll is really going to be where the magic lies. In this case, it was actually really very rewarding. Because one of the things that I studied a bunch beforehand and that we paid a lot of attention to throughout the trip was just these elements of Incan architecture. And I hadn't quite appreciated just how amazing the civilization of Peru is, because we think of the Incas as, you know, one of the great civilizations of the New World. But it was really only about 100, 150 years old as an imperial force when the Spanish encountered them.
And yeah, they were new.
They were new, and they were just riding on top of this layer of civilization that goes back to the time of the early pyramids and of the earliest civilizations in China and in Babylon. In fact, like, I hadn't realized just how old, and they keep finding older pyramids, just how old something like the state was in Peru, much older than in Mesoamerica, than with the Mexican civilization. So there's, you know, you're returning to like one of the origins of modern humans in this space. And then the fact that they don't have any writing means that almost everything people are saying is conjecture. So it's got that mysterious quality of Stonehenge or rock art. There's something very, it's not like it's from the Neolithic, but there's something very ancient about it in the sense that we really just don't know. I mean, they know a lot about what the Incans thought because they were people who were, you know, talking to the Spanish, and they wrote stuff down, and, you know, there's a lot of material, but at the same time, especially when you go farther back before the Incans, it gets very mysterious. So there's a lot of that wonderful mystery that, you know, is just, you know, how are you going to read these rocks? How are you going to read the organization of these temples? How are you going to see the way that they did certain things? But at the same time, there's things that are very visible, and the part that really intrigued me as I'm a lover of sacred landscape and sacred architecture, and how the architecture is folded into a landscape, into an environment, is the most remarkable thing about these guys was the way in which they integrated built structures with natural forms. So, like,
right. Yeah.
You'd be, you know, you're looking at a, you know, one of the most sophisticated, some of the most sophisticated masonry I've ever seen, stonework that I've ever seen. Very abstract, very little figuration of human figures or animal figures, very much into the abstraction, and sometimes almost kind of like a grid, like, you know, these X's of massive blocks of stone, but then right in the middle of a wall, there'd be like a natural stone outcropping that just kind of sticks out.
Right, like rough.
Why didn't they, you know, take that away if they wanted to just create these walls? And then it turns out that you start to see the way in which the built landscape is folded into the flows and the powers of the natural landscape, and you start to really get a sense of, like, the charge of their art and the way in which they were tapping natural flow. So it's something that I got partly because I was reading these accounts and, you know, archaeologists and art historians talking about the role of stone and when a stone is alive and when a stone, you know, it's all this kind of sense of the animistic quality of these remains. And since you can't talk to the people, but you can look at these stones, you can look at these walls, and there are ways of understanding it, experiencing messages, experiencing some sensibility of how to be in the world that can come through these things. And you don't know it's 100%, but there is a kind of communication there.
Let me ask you that, because this is really a kind of fascinating question to consider, is that clearly they were describing some kind of pattern, and it was related to nature, like in that same kind of golden rectangle kind of thing. Through the architecture, you could tell they're intelligent and they're communicating something or taking advantage of communicating a nature that's already there. So what do you think about the fact that there was no language, it seemingly, in this area, at least recorded, okay, that there wasn't, they didn't have that ability for writing,
but they had
all that other understanding. Like, what is that? Like, how is it that they can have that kind of thing, but then it just doesn't get to writing? Do you think that was, like, some thing done on purpose, or they just
question. It's an extraordinary question because it really makes us think about, you know, when we think about civilization, you know, not meaning human culture, because, of course, human culture is much older than civilization, but when you think about developed civilization where there's social stratification and there's, you know, an elite and there's some kind of religious system that organizes the cosmos and within which people find their way and that motivates, you know, the sort of larger forms of and complex
yeah.
forms of society, you think like, well, there's got to be writing. I mean, there's always writing. There's Chinese characters and, you know, cuneiform and hieroglyphs and da-da-da. And it's like, no. there actually doesn't have to be. Now, they did have a recording device. I'm actually, the name of it's slipping my mind. I feel ashamed for my own idiocy. But these systems of knots in strings that were clearly used to count and keep records of a certain sort. Although they're not really decrypted. I don't think people really have a. In fact, I'm sure people don't really have a really clear idea of how they worked. But they were clearly used for some kind of recording because. It's hard to imagine how you'd have a state without any way of recording information over time, and clearly also you have people's memories,
right.
which can maintain a lot. But it's kind of a wonderful reminder that some of these things we think of as being absolutely necessary aren't absolutely necessary. Another example is some of the earliest civilizations in cities in Peru are from cultures that don't have ceramics, and when they discovered mm-hmm. those were the first examples of civilizations that didn't have ceramics. They always thought that was a given.
Right.
You had to have ceramics, yep. otherwise you're not going to have a way to hold goods
water.
And record things. And I'm not exactly sure what all of the particular reasons were, but it's another example of how you don't always get the whole picture. So it's really a remarkable thing. And then, you know, so one of the paradoxes that I remember we talked a lot about was, an interesting thing about our crew was it was this wonderful combination, which in some ways is the combination I kind of strive to live my life in is you know, on the one hand, there is a commitment to knowledge, to history, to understanding, to thinking through what's valuable in science, critical thinking, understanding politics, understanding the problems and complexities of the modern world. And on the other hand, this openness towards spirituality, towards mythology, towards story, towards magic, enchantment, the multiple ways that human beings have come to sort of manifest the sacred. And it was a very interesting mix because both of those things were really animating the group of people I was with. Some of the people were very, very deep students of Peruvian shamanism and had studied with masters in different traditions in Peru, and then other people have these more sort of scientific archaeological knowledges, and so it was a very wonderful mix. And one of the things that I found myself contemplating that I've thought about before with Mesoamerican civilization is that on the one hand you have these groups that are so clearly deeply nature-oriented in their cosmology. I mean, to use the term in a overly broad way, they're very pagan. There's very much a sense of cyclicity between human and natural environments, between animals and stars and water and stone and earth. And it's this, you know, this all of these elements that we have lost so much of in the West and that so many people lament the loss of, you know, and that we live in this world of abstraction and technology and we're detached from these currents and flows, and that a lot of the spiritual practices that we talk about in the show are people trying to like recover and reanimate and re-enchant the world. And so here you go, like, here, these guys had it. They were living it. The stone was alive. It's alive with spirit. There's connections to the animals, da-da-da. But there's still just, you know, imperialists.
Yeah,
you know, they're still,
right,
like, taking over local people, extending their empire, extraordinary, you know, thousands of miles along the Andes, absorbing other groups, you know, going to other groups and saying, oh, well, we'll take your god and bring it back to our hometown of Cusco and setting it up. And so it's this weird, like, wait a second, which, like, they're both things. They're both, it's both,
yeah,
the state that I hate, that I see around me taken to a crazy technological level in our globalized world, and it's the appreciation and art of living with natural flows and powers and animal spirits and this whole rich, you know, a kind of enchantment. And I'm like, oh, it's both and, you know, so it's a very...
Well, it's kind of amazing, too, like, to think and consider for a moment the implications of what you're saying. It's like there's the most kind of shamanically grounded human beings living that life there in that place, where at the same time, occupying the same time and space, are these kind of like greedy demon parasite individuals that are literally raping the earth, the oil and minerals, and just taking everything they want. And somehow there's two human beings, almost like different species, are occupying that same place, you know?
Yeah, well, they're certainly not as bad as the Spanish who come, you know. That's the other thing, is that the story of the conquest of that place is just this bloody nightmare.
Brutal.
I mean, oh my God, it's extraordinary, you know, and it's very, very, you know, real and dense, you know, in with all that, the kind of thickness of history. And so it's really, really an extraordinary place. I was really surprised, you know, and we went to Machu Picchu at the end of the trip, and I, you know, I was pretty nervous about that, because I sometimes things go bad in my head when I go to hyper tourist places like Parthenon or wherever, you know, where there's just too many people, and they're for many of them are there in a very casual way where they don't really pay attention, and they're just
at the Parthenon, yeah, it was terrible. Like, you go in and you're looking at this thing that you can't even believe was built by human beings. You're like struck in the most intense awe and wonder ever, looking at this like marble sculpture someone made with their hands. And then there's like some like woman picking her underwear out of her butt in front of you, that's like chewing gum and looking around and bored on her cell phone. And it becomes this like extraordinary.
There's really
disparity.
Nothing quite like that kind of tourist moment where you taste the sort of horrible idiocy of our world, and it's partly because you also have this desire for something else, and in a way that desire is very beautiful, and it can be informed by sensitivity, but it's also because you want to escape the world you live in, and there you are looking at the pure evidence of the world you live in, and it could be a very disturbing experience. So I was very concerned about it. It was also incredibly expensive. I mean, it's a racket, basically, to go to Machu Picchu, and it's, you know, it's much worse now than it was 5 years ago, which was worse than it was 10 years. You know what I mean? It's just ramped up into a big, you know, money suck, and you're basically getting on a ride, you know, where you every step of the way, it's all set up for money extraction and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the place was so extraordinary. There was such fineness of masonry, so many powerful, powerful conjunctions of rock and particularly the way in which it was embedded in the landscape was so powerful that it really didn't matter. I mean, one of the marvelous things about the way that the Incans sort of animated the stones they used, both the stones that they worked and the stones, more natural stones that they incorporated into their sites, is that they had this idea, some people call them echo stones. So you're walking around a site, and there's, let's say, this natural-shaped stone that's embedded very consciously in, you know, onto a platform, and you notice that the shape of the stone echoes the shape of the distant mountain.
Wow.
And the whole idea is that it's not a representation of that distant mountain. It's like a way of drawing or focalizing the energy of that mountain.
Yeah, that's that's like one of the theories of the pyramids, is that they echo the Belt of Orion, right?
So
exactly. It's the same concept, and that's really what a lot of occultists view as above, so below. As it's
exactly.
A comparison, it's a metaphor. So if you do like the likeness of the thing, it draws the energy of that thing into that place.
Right,
yeah.
And you can, in this context, it's like being sensitive to that. It's not like an enormous leap. You can feel it. You know, you feel you're in that world of correspondences, and so suddenly, like, things become alive, even if it's the people are gone. It's overlaid with all these, you know, hyper modern tourist layers, and there's tour guides and people wearing T-shirts and all that kind of stuff. There's still this sort of resonance that reminds you of another way of being, that there are other ways of organizing and relating to the cosmos. And while most of those echoes are of the natural environments around, particularly the mountains, which are so important to Andean religion to this day, there was one stone some people think, I mean, there's debate about it, but there was one stone in Machu Picchu that also seems to echo a celestial element of the Southern Cross, or it's really more of a diamond than a cross. But and that's so you really get that sense of the ways in which the different levels of reality are also linked, which in their cosmology is a three level of a, you know, a kind of upper world and our world and a lower underworld, and how all those are, you know, linked between these resonating webs.
Yeah, the holograms, right? It's like
exactly.
You make a smaller version of the bigger thing, and now you kind of like ritualistically, magically made it your own hologram, like a low-budget hologram. It's like a ghetto hologram.
A stone hologram. I like a hologram stone. Well, this is cool. We'll keep chatting. We're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Majid Daou. We're having a loose-limbed conversation today about travel, and I think we're going to turn towards the topic of mental health soon, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majid Daou, and I'm here today with Eric Davis. We are chit-chatting on the state of the nation, or more appropriately, the state of ourselves, as we are right now. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the stones and stuff like that, and there's a good segue, surprisingly enough, for the mental health topic that came up earlier regarding the stones, because one of the things I was researching the most with mental health is some of the treatments that they give, and also researching some of like the way back in the day treatments that people would give, like folk remedies or in ancient Taoist medicine or even like Ayurvedic. What are some ways that other cultures treat it? And surprisingly enough, it's with like these rocks or metals is kind of seems to be the thing. So people use the rocks and the architecture, and a lot of people like study crystals and you know, all those kind of ideas about the power that's in rocks, but they're also one of the main strategy treatments for mental health issues, which I always think is amazing, because it's like in Chinese medicine they give you heavy metals or like shells or stones or, you know, oyster shells, things that are like heavy or earthy or come from, you know, rocks in the earth to kind of weigh you down because you're floating away like in your head, right? And then, of course, one of the main treatments that they have for it pharmaceutically are the lithiums, and, you know, they actually do treat it with heavy metals and kind of stones. So I always think about that. Like, how could it be that just putting earth into your body would then somehow alter your state of mind out of a hyper mental one and sort of back into your body?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, I mentioned before about how what particularly interested me before I went there was this question of rocks and of and of the animating power of rocks. And I've thought a lot about that. I mean, we've talked about animism on this show a lot, or the kind of new ways of thinking about an animist worldview. And, you know, within that worldview, you know, you can think about the animation of clouds or of plants or of all sorts of things. But for me, like, the rock is almost the best place to tune into that, because from our given Western perspective, there's nothing that's more dead than a rock. There's nothing that's more empty of any kind of energy or life or potential. I mean, you know, in some physics sense, there is some kind of, you know, it can be used as a battery or whatever. But, like, but basically, it's off the charts of animism. And yet, within so many traditions, you know, rocks and metals have so many special powers in this kind of potential sort of animation. And that came up a lot. There was one. Kind of a very interesting mutant guy. He was head of archaeology at Machu Picchu for like 20 years, but he was also a shaman. And so he had this really interesting kind of angle, and he was talking a lot about the rocks and the rocks that they would choose to use and the ones that had more quartz in them, and, you know, and this idea of being able to charge rocks. And one of the other elements that I didn't really mention in terms of the Peruvian cosmology or the Incan architectural cosmology is that the way that you would charge these stones is with liquid, whether it's water or blood. And sometimes the blood was from llamas, and sometimes it was from human beings. But the whole idea that you would sort of charge things, but not just because stones were dead, but that they had a different, it's like almost like they had a different rate of flow, and you sort of intensified their flow with the more obvious flow.
No, that's
flow
what,
of,
so you know,
water.
Like in Santeria, right, they have their El Agua stone, and they charge it with blood. Like, that's exactly what they do. Yeah.
Sure. And it was interesting, there was a lot of also stones. One of the Peruvian traditions, which is not so well known here in the States, which is kind of interesting because South American shamanism is so hot these days. But they have, you know, a different shamanic tradition that's not as primeval, perhaps, as jungle ayahuasca shamanism, but it's San Pedro shamanism, where they heal through the use of the psychedelic cactus San Pedro, which is actually, you know, throughout our world. I mean, you see them every day. People have them in their backyards. They just don't know that they have mescaline in them. And they're very powerful allies. And the healers that in one of the traditions in Peru, or one set of traditions from the North Coast, the healers that use this medicine also have these very elaborate ritual tables called mesas that are filled with objects, and the objects on these tables, they're also participating in that cosmic web of correspondences that we talked about earlier, the way that the stone would echo the distant mountain. Also on these mesas, there's often a lot of stones which themselves are echoes of specific mountain powers that the shamans will work with. So you still have that idea of these kind of power objects, and some of them are very specific stones. There's a lot of meteorite in the Andes, and some of these are meteorites some of the elements have been used in, you know, Incan implements. And they also use keys a lot. They use colonial keys, those big, heavy metal keys from the 17th century as sort of symbols, but not just symbols. They're also kind of operative objects. You know, they're objects that have their own.
Well, it's kind of like the idea with the rocks, I always say, is like magic wands, right? So a magic wand has the magic because it's a tree, right? So the idea of a wand's magic and how it's made out of like an oak, now you have the whole power of a giant oak, but just in like this little object you can hold in your hand. Similarly with the rocks, if you have like a little quartz crystal, now you have that whole power of quartz crystal that you can kind of like carry around in your pocket, right? So you got a key. Now you have like that whole power of the key, and you can just have a little object you can carry.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So here's a question that's coming up for me now in terms of also your own work and seeing the people who come to you and the people who are having mental difficulties and the whole struggle to heal in our world today, where on the one, you know, again, to keep coming back to this split, on the one hand, we see the way that the Western paradigm is insufficient, and then there's a draw towards these animist models. We have so much spiritual desire, and you know, one of the things going to a place like Peru, you know, I almost feel embarrassed when I got back that I didn't like take any drugs. You know, it's like, no, I didn't go to the jungle and have ayahuasca. I'm sorry. You know, it's like I didn't, because that's like, it's so much a part what it's like. That's what tourism in Peru is for many people. And in fact, we could see groups who weren't necessarily people who were drinking substances. There's also people who go there who are whatever you call them, New Age tours. And you know, they're in the sites, and there's all these people, you know, usually middle-aged women, and they're like, you know, putting the objects in the water, and they have their different colored staffs, and there's someone who's a shaman or a quote unquote shaman. I don't really know how to characterize them. Who gets to say who's a real shaman?
Right. Totally.
But somebody who's
good
sort
point.
Of meeting these people, and you know, it's on the one hand, when I see this, or we saw this, on the one hand, I'm like, I totally understand where this is coming from. This is a healthy desire to reconnect, to sort of come up with other healing modalities, to find a way outside of the kind of prison of the West. But on the other hand, I look at them and I go, there's so much sort of ignorance and projection, and there's so little, there's often so little understanding of the real situation of these places and these people. And so then I look at the crusty guy who was leading us around, not one of my friends, but one of the people that a guy who organized part of our trip, where we did this massive grueling hike into a distant Incan ruin. And he was an old Peru hand. He'd been there for decades. He'd discovered archaeological sites. He knew tons of stuff. He wasn't really a spiritual guy. And he, you know, the account that then he would give of these people was, you know, much more fine and nuanced and intelligent than a lot of these sort of tourist models. So I'm kind of stuck, you know, I'm stuck in this zone of like, not, you know, I appreciate the move towards enchantment, but it also looks kind of like an illusion, and so, or not illusion, but
it's like a
projection.
Cannibalistic. It's like a cannibalistic enchantment, though, because they're like, they want the enchantment, so they find this. Oh, this place has enchantment. Let's go eat the enchantment there at that place. I hear they have great enchantment in Peru. Let's go eat some.
Dude, you're so right. That is the best metaphor for it. It's so. That's.
It's like enchantment McDonald's, dude.
No, that's funny you even say that with the food metaphor, because I can't remember exactly how it was, but there was this hilarious sign that we saw in one town called Pisac, which is in the Sacred Valley, and by an absolutely phenomenal ruin up in the mountains. But it was sort of like, the sign was, I remember it, ayahuasca diet soup.
Oh, my God.
And we're like, I think they mean tea, and I think they mean dieta rather than diet. But, like, the whole thing was, like, a symptom of this weird crossover where all of these traditions are being repackaged and transformed and da-da-da-da in this way that's very, you know, just very disturbing, I think, for people who are interested in maintaining as traditional a framework as you can, and even maybe not even participating precisely out of the ability to let these people, you know, do their own culture. Because when you have a culture when you have people who don't have a lot of money, and then wealthy Westerners come down and they want their culture, then they're going to repackage some of the most intimate elements of their lives, or their grandfathers' lives in some cases, in order to feed this desire. And it's not like something real can't happen in that context. Obviously,
no, it's
does.
Not. And that's the hardest part about it, is that the reason they're repackaging it is because it's legit, right? And that's like, you're right, they're put in this dilemma where they're like, oh my God, we have this awesome thing. We know our soul. Like, we know how to hook up our spirit and become, like, you know, connected to the earth. And then everyone else is like, well, I want that. Like, give me that. How do I get that? And they're like, well, you know, we live in this dirt. We got nothing. Like, first of all, you got to come to us. So,
yeah.
And then you got to hang out and do this stuff. But how do you arrange for someone to just have an experience like that when, like you said, this is their life and their situation? And how do you commodify a cultural way of life to transmit that in order to help people heal? You know, that's
a
trick.
Yeah, it's super tricky. And then, you know, I think one of the things we chat about before, just before the show, was, you know, my however critical I might be of shamanic tourism, of the distortion effect that money has, the degree to which people are able to just project their fantasies and then have them fulfilled by people, and all the sort of problems that come up with that, at the same time, coming back here and you know, and then also just the whole Elliot Rodgers shooting in Santa Barbara and the whole discourse around it, like, just coming back here, even though I was only gone a couple of weeks and I only spent one of those away from a city where we were, you know, just hiking in the country, and we had whatever, it was very easy comparatively. Nonetheless, there was still a sort of, a, you know, I kind of journeyed away from my normal American West Coast information matrix. And coming back here, it's just my fundamental, basic, deeply intuitive gut feeling was this kind of, I hate to say it, this kind of nausea and horror of just how crazy and screwed up.
It's insanity.
It was like, oh God, it can't be that bad. I have to figure out some other way to think about this because this is too overwhelming. And you see that, and so I understand with all of those distortions and with all of the tragedies and the absurdities and the ironies of it. I understand why there is that desire and that need, and if some of it is just another form of consumerism or of cannibalism, as you put it so wonderfully, there's also something very, very urgent and real in there, and it's a conundrum. And so I'm curious, you know, for you, you said this month of mental illness has been, or mental health month has been one where you've confronted a lot of mental illness in your clients and others, and thought a lot about it, and it's precisely this question: how do we engage with modern people, or ourselves being modern people? We have these terrible problems. It's terribly difficult often, and part of us are objects of modern science, and we have these pills, and they have to have certain effects, and there's certain stories around them, and those can be very necessary at certain points, and at the very same time, we recognize the limitations of those and the possibilities of other worlds, but we can go too far in that direction too and make stupid moves and become deluded and how do you see people navigating this very difficult in-between place?
Everybody is frustrated is how I see people navigating. I mean, people are getting stuck. They're having difficulty getting through. And I'm so sympathetic because, like, in my kind of the way I present myself, it doesn't have the same stigma as going to a psychiatrist, okay, and saying, like, you know, I have a mental illness. So I feel like many people, before they'll go and get treatment, whether that's, like, forced or of their own volition. They don't know. How do you know that you have a mental health problem, okay? Like, that's the problem. It's consensus. Mental health is a consensus, right? The only difference between someone who's masturbating in Wendy and someone who's getting paid to do it on YouTube is that one looks better than the other one doing it, right? But the one who does it in Wendy's gets arrested and is now mentally ill. So, you know, there's all kinds of differentiators there. But you have to come to the place where it's like they won't, you don't know that you have a mental health issue. And so I think a lot of people will go to the occult because they, something is happening. They don't know what it is. They're trying to get an explanation. And then you have the other people with mental health issues. They go to the doctors. And you, like you said, you know, can't, I have no judgments for that. But meds, you know, if you're messed up, you're suffering, like you got to do something. But then I also see people who have been on meds for years and they still suffer. There's no, you know, there's no kind of answer given in any real capacity with the meds. It'll treat it, it'll keep it at bay, but then it leads to all these other problems, like everybody committing suicide. You know, I read about the veterans mental health, what's come out this month. I don't know if you've been following that with the whole veterans affairs. Now they say one third of veterans are mentally ill. You know, and that's a statement. They train men to kill people, put them in places, have them kill people, and then call them mentally ill. I just, you cannot make a diagnosis of someone as mentally ill that you have programmed to perform this function, right, and then have them come back and they're violent, and now you're going to call them mentally ill. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what they did, they've developed this brain chip now. This just came out in the news that they're going to try to put into vets' brains to treat PTSD, and this is like that treatment. So it's like, you can't win. You know, you can
deal
with it.
That's so horrifying. You know, and it's funny, too, because just the whole, we always have to remember, I mean, like in this conversation, we've used the phrase mental health and mental illness a lot. We started out talking about it. We did it. And we all more or less know what that means. And we can use those words sort of, you know, transparently. But we forget, and we always have to remember and should remember, that those are very ideological words. They're very loaded words. And one of the things that they disguise that we forget, particularly, you know, in the West, is that they disguise a whole assumption about mental life, psychic life, the life of the mind, the life of the soul. They disguise it as just the way things are. And what that they disguise is the notion that these things are not a matter of meaning, and they are a matter of machine, of physiology, of determined mechanisms.
That's what I say. I'm like, listen, it's considered mentally ill to have hallucinations and disassociate from reality when you're awake, but not when you're asleep, right? So, like, it's absolutely normal for every single human being to have delusions and disassociate from reality as long as it's done after a certain time at night, right? So the idea, like you said, of defining it, of trying to do it, we're not looking at what we are as human beings to get a good definition of that, I don't think. But like you said, it is, it's wiggly. You
right, and so then when you see is that hidden, that's the trick about, I mean, there's a lot of tricks about it. One is that it's not that it's not effective. It's not that the mechanist model doesn't work in many cases. And in fact, there's even a special, to think shamanically, put on a shamanic hat, there's actually a certain power to elements of the mechanistic model. It has a certain kind of ability to deal with certain sorts of problems of the soul. So it's by no means, I'm by no means a, you know, anti-Western, you know, medicine totalist in any kind of way. But what's sneaky is the way in which the language of mental health disguises the way that it's continuing to medicalize or mechanize, really, all of these elements of our psychic life that are arguably just as well dealt, if not better dealt with a language of meaning, of encounter, of resonance, of dream, of, you know, all these other kind of zones. And that it's sort of, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, where that the mechanistic model leads is a chip in your brain. Like the idea, like
exactly.
that, you know, if you're thinking about a problem to the extent that you go that the solution lies in a chip in the brain,
yeah.
You know,
ta-da.
That's telling you. I mean, it's almost like
you're
the chip in the brain.
You had to be exposed to severe trauma and violence. We'll stick this in there now. There you go.
Yeah. So that is a very, very disturbing, you know, element as well as the Elliot Rodger event was also very disturbing and
yeah.
and just to, I mean, though we only have a couple of minutes here, you know, it's worth just making one thing that I noted that was very interesting is that I totally understand why there was a very big feminist hue and cry and the sort of response about how this shows about the, you know, the how it's there's continued to be this objectification of women and the sense of entitlement and men and all those kind of things. And I totally, you know, understand why that's there and that it's obviously a part of this guy's twisted mind stream. But to me, one of the most notable things was the fact that this guy came from such privilege. I mean, like, when I first heard about it, I was like,
he's a spoiled brat.
A BMW, and there was one thing that really stayed with me. I didn't read that much about it because I don't get too obsessed with that kind of stuff. Although I couldn't help it in this case, someone had collected like all these selfies he had taken at various sort of fancy events. You know, the premiere of this or the secret after party of that or whatever with celebrities and everything. And there were all these like creepy shots like of him like inside his car. So I could see him sort of trying to like mediate his own sense of identity through these, you know, through cameras and through the internet. But there's nothing there. You know, there's no there. But the fact that you can do it in this space of privilege sort of insulates it from any kind of anything that's going to challenge it. And so it just
exactly.
It was a slice of hell that I just, it was very, very disturbing. I mean, I can, you know, I can't, it's, you know, it's terrible to contemplate the results of that kind of thing. But yet it does.
It's mechanistic. It's robotic, like you said, you know. True.
You know, I mean, it's just that we should, that it's too easy to go, oh, this is a problem of mental illness. How come the doctors weren't able to alert the cops? And it's like, no, this is something about how our society is constructing meaning and personality.
It's deeper than that.
We have to look at this guy as not just some...
It's because we don't have enchantment. If everyone... This, my idea is if everyone has techniques or access to techniques where they can hook up with their own subconscious, they're going to be less driven to get compulsory or think they have to have stuff because they're going to know who they are. So I think it's like the Peruvians, you know? We can't go get enchantment from someone else like a vampire. We have to be enchanted. And if we are enchanted and teach other people how to do that, I think we're just going to see less of this kind of stuff.
Yeah. For me, it's also about being critically enchanted, that we can't just dive in because all sorts of other things are. But anyway, this has been a wonderful conversation, Maja. Thanks for inviting me back in with these great questions. And
thanks, Eric.
And next week we'll return to our usual conversations with other folks. So from me and Maja, all you out there, keep your minds open.